wing. He's been a Washington insider. Now he's one of the Capitol's top journalists, Chris Matthews.
Hi, I'm Chris Matthews. Welcome to the show. Let's go inside. Cokie Roberts is the longtime ABC News correspondent. Patty Kaye is Washington correspondent for the British Broadcasting Corporation. John Meacham is managing editor of Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, Franklin and Winston. And Tucker Carlson is co-host of CNN's Crossfire. First up, marooned in Mesopotamia, George W. Bush this week gave this assessment of the situation in Iraq.
I can't put it any more plainly. Iraq's a dangerous place. That's leveling. It is a dangerous place.
A dangerous place, Cokie. Not only that, but we're trying to arrange to grab a lot more recruits into the Iraqi militias to protect us and our friends over there. What's it tell you?
That it's a dangerous place, right. And that the president and the administration is very nervous about the number of casualties that keep mounting. And as you said, the Red Cross pulling out, our friends pulling out. They've got to make it safe enough for people to be there and stay there. But, arming a lot of Iraqis might not make it so safe.
Tucker, the newspapers, not just the big papers like the Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times, but all the small-town papers of the country have been over the past several months reported casualties. How long do you think this can last?
Well, I've actually been surprised by how the men and women running against President Bush, the nine Democratic candidates, have not emphasized casualties yet. Mostly they've complained about the cost, but they haven't made, as the primary focus, the number of people who've been killed. I think they've read the polls that show Americans actually can put up with a lot of casualties as long as they think the war is justified, any war is justified and going well. At some point, that may change, probably coalesce around a big story like the famous Life and Look magazine stories during Vietnam. I don't know. It hasn't happened yet.
How it goes, John, depends not on us but our friends in Iraq, the ones we're able to recruit to the cause of rebuilding that country. Mm-hmm. I was struck by the death the other day of that fellow who had just come back from the donors meeting in Madrid, so happy he had raised billions of dollars, told his family that, his wife that, the next morning he's playing dominoes in a cafe and blown apart.
Right. It's a terrible mess. And I think we've now seen attacks on, when you think about it, three of the most important international institutions, the United Nations, the Red Cross, and frankly, the United States of America. And we consider ourselves a force for stability. And until we really recruit more people on the ground to be on our side, then we're going to be in trouble in that Sunni triangle and elsewhere.
How do we trust, Caddy, how do we trust the Iraqis to protect us? Weren't they the ones that were protecting the big UN installation a few months back? And it looked like an inside job. Can we trust the Iraqis to protect us?
Shut the hell up, Chris Matthews and gang. This nonsense about, I can't put it any more plainly, Iraq is a dangerous place. The question is, why is Iraq a dangerous place, boy George? Because your red, white, and blue imperialist ass keeps stalking into places where you don't belong without any regard for human life. But, well, that's what it means to be an American patriot. For the imperialists. And then you guys babble out. I don't think Democrats have read the polls and found, I think Democrats have read the polls and found that Americans can put up with a lot of casualties as long as they feel the war is going well. In other words, a lot of sorry American types keep the philosophy, as long as I got my cheese, I don't care who my government crushes to its knees. Well, the cheese is turning stale. And they about to draft your ass. It's slave revolt time. Check this out. You're listening to 104.1. 93.7 San Francisco, 96.3 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, the world's slave revolt time. Tonight we got Gerald shooting his way into the Making It Plain news as he'll deal with the defense rally for the Oakland 25 concerning the April 7th police assault. And then it's time for the U.S. out of Iraq now, by whatever means. And then a successful general strike in Lebanon. Then we'll deal with how the corporate media deals with issues of politics of war, from O'Reilly to Meet the Press to NPR, all that and hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt Radio.
America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crowned thy good with the brotherhood of a select group of liars, cheaters, and thieves who used that brotherhood to form the most arbitrary and ambiguous history the world has come to know. Red, white, and blue, the symbolism of hypocrisy and bureaucratic stagnation. Men of power glossing the fault line cracks. In historical facts, red, white, and blue, those stars and stripes for never. Never again will I take a back seat, genuflect those my equal, sing that whining anthem or tatter my clothing with those tired ass colors. Blue. Blue is the mood that sweeps my emotions into a disastrousness of color me sad. Color me gray, color me gloomy when thinking of those colors, patriotic white. White are the ghost-faced pointed hoods swinging my ancestor from the tree that fed life back into earth to breed in abundance the fork-tongued serpent, erecting sacrilegious torches in the face of the phoenix who takes flight up out of the ash, leaving that glow in its dust, its winged fans spreading a shadow over hatred. And I see red. Red are my bloodshot eyes streaming tears down that flag shrouded in glory, glory, hallelujah. My country, tears of thee, waving embers across purple mountains majestic only to those who believe. While in the sky, atmospheric radiation beams down, singeing surf and turf, blistering the feet of the unprepared, running, running, running from those poisonous rays, seeking to alleviate your pain, caking your face with sunblock 2000, covering up your face, covering up your skin, covering up your history of bad blood and foul misinterpretations. Running from each other, running out of the frying pan and into the fiery douses of hell, and forever will you burn with those crosses of iniquity, and let those you've abused inherit your precious earth. So fly your flag in hell, still streaming down its acts of change and cover-up that have insistently been deemed necessary. And I will cry. Cry social injustice. Cry racism, cry sacrilege, cry freedom from sea to shining sea. My tears will not provide you with escape. And you, your pointed hoods and your smoking crosses shall burn forever, marching in the parade of hell's fire and brimstone.
Brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm Gerald Smith, and this is your Making It Plain News Service. Check this, y'all. Here are 8 simple rules for Schwarzenegger to follow or else get clubbed. A driving force behind the conservative storm front in America will quite likely be the governor's mentor, and in the course steer the socially liberal Arnold towards a starkly conservative agenda. Okay? California governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger named Stephen Moore to the audit committee, said Moore of the announcement, quote, I look forward to serving his administration and will work to implement solutions that will put gold back in the Golden State. But as you will soon discover, the driving force behind the conservative storm front in America will quite likely be the governor's mentor. And in the course, steer the socially liberal Arnold towards a starkly conservative agenda. Now, just a brief bio of this Stephen Moore, so you know who you're going to be dealing with. Stephen Moore is the president of, quote, the Club for Growth, unquote, an organization that funds the most free market-oriented candidates in targeted congressional races. The Club for Growth has grown sixfold since the year 2000 election cycle, and the club and its members raised or donated over $10 million to help elect 17 new members of Congress in the 2002 elections. All right, so get this. Stephen Moore is also a senior fellow of the Cato Institute, with degrees in economics from the University of Illinois and George Mason University. Remember, that University of Illinois, that was the Chicago Circle. That's where they came out with Milton Friedman and all them, you know, the shock treatment, chili, and all of that madness. Okay. Mr. Moore is a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, Investors, Business Daily, the Washington Post, National Review, and many other publications. So this is who's going to be handling the money here in the Golden States. Keep your hand over your pocket. Today, at 1:30, there was a rally in support of the Oakland 25 anti-war protesters. You may recall, if you're listening to Slave Revolt, you certainly will recall, because we interviewed the people the next day. That week, we interviewed them here on Slave Revolt. That's right, I'm tooting our horn. On April the 7th, 2003, the Oakland Police Department opened fire on a peaceful anti-war picket line in the Port of Oakland protesting the war profiteers shipping military cargo. That was SSA, is the contractor. Stevedoring Services of America, I think it stands for. The demonstration was called by direct action to stop the war. Dozens of demonstrators and 9 longshore workers, members of the ILWU, International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, Local 10, who were honoring the picket line, were seriously injured by the indiscriminate police use of so-called non-lethal weaponry, which included wooden dowels, rubber bullets, concussion grenades, and beanbag projectiles. Now, I want you to understand, when they say non-lethal and when we say non-lethal, you're getting two different things. These weapons can theoretically be non-lethal if they are used in a non-lethal manner. What does that mean? As a person that has served on Cop Watch and have been to police commission meetings, I've read more than I care to on these non-lethal weapons. Here's how it works. When you have a shotgun that shoots plastic bullets, that's designed to shoot plastic bullets, it is non-lethal insofar as you do not shoot people in the head at point-blank range. It is non-lethal to use these wooden projectiles insofar as you aim the weapon towards the ground so that it hits protesters below the belt, is what it was designed to do. And I am now prepared to say that even if they are used as a manufacturer specified, the damage that they can cause far outweighs any social use they may have. If it's supposed to be a lowering of the pole of violence by the police. Today, I had the misfortune to see the leg of one of these protesters where a whole portion of her calf was simply missing. I was dumbfounded. I didn't think that these little old so-called non-lethal weapons could do such damage. Remember, this is now 7 months since this occurred. 7 months! And this woman has this huge chunk of her calf gone because of the so-called non-lethal weaponry. 25 were also arrested, including Jack Heyman, local 10 business agent, who was dragged from his car, roughed up, and then arrested for the so-called crime of trying to warn his members of the violent police attack. They're now facing criminal charges for exercising their basic democratic right to rally and to demonstrate. So people came out today to support the defenders at their pretrial hearing. Defend the right to demonstrate at the Port of Oakland, in the city of Oakland, in the Bay Area, or any place else we feel that it's necessary to struggle. And also, I might add, we demand that all these charges be dropped against the Oakland 25. Now, moving on to Iraq, I know that people are, I hope that people are aware of the Black Hawk that was brought down. Oh, I'm sorry, the helicopter that was brought down. Here is information from Patrick Coburn, the brother of the other Coburn. Here, what's his brother's name? Here. Alexander Coburn, who is a journalist here in America. Patrick works out of England. In the deadliest single attack, this is the bloodiest day in Iraq for Americans. On the United States Army, since it invaded Iraq, guerrillas shot down a Chinook helicopter with a missile, killing 15 and wounding 21 American servicemen. The U.S. Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, called the incident a national tragedy for Americans. The Chinook, which came down in a field near Fallujah, west of Baghdad, was one of two 84-foot long transport helicopters attacked shortly after they took off from the airbase at about 9 a.m. on a routine flight. These were ferrying more than 50 soldiers on a rest break from the 82nd Airborne Division to a military base at Baghdad International Airport. As the helicopters passed over the village of Buisa, set in rich farmland filled with cattle and crops, guerrillas hidden in a date grove fired two shoulder-launched ground-to-air missiles, probably from a Russian heat-seeking SA-7 known as the Strela. There are many of them in Iraq, and they were formerly used by the Iraqi army. Dayal Saluman, a farmer working among the date palms, said, quote, "I saw two helicopters pass overhead when two missiles were fired at them. One missed and the other hit a helicopter at the rear end, and flames started coming out of it before it crashed into a field. I saw the helicopter try to stay in the air after it was hit, but then it got close to the ground and I saw some soldiers jump out." He said the helicopter that was not hit fired a flare to divert the missile. Minutes after the attack, American Black Hawk helicopters swarmed over the scene to rush survivors to the hospital while soldiers secured the site, ordering journalists to leave the and confiscating film. They do not want you to see Sam getting his ass whooped, getting that ass waxed. They don't want this.
Well, it's the same way how they also tried to bar the media, corporate media, from filming any of their little G.I. Joes. They got their little asses blown off, legs, penises, whatever. So, you know, it's the same old thing they've been running for a long time. They were mad at Alta Zero a while back for showing some little dead G.I. Joes. So, this is the way they play the game, the art of the illusion.
And are losing the game big time. For instance, just today, another helicopter was shot down and five Americans on board were killed. Also, it appears that the ways that Americans are revealing their demoralization, I'm talking about American soldiers now, is varied. Earlier on, about a month or so ago, I reported that 11 Americans had committed suicide. It is now up to 40. 40 young men, American young men, have committed suicide in Iraq. And they had people coming home like for, you know, a little rest and relaxation. They call it R&R. You get a little, I don't know, what they give them, Jane? 2 weeks, 15 days, 2 weeks. But guess what? Out of the 1,000 that have been sent and returned, 63 have not returned. 63 are AWOL. This is an indication of something.
They're doing the Boy George.
Oh, that's right. Tell them what you're talking about so make sure they don't nobody lose that.
Well, when Boy George's time had come during the Vietnam War, of course, his pappy set him up to be in some kind of like National Guard. And he served it for a while, and then all of a sudden he went up missing. And instead of them tracking him down and throwing him in prison, they just basically just wrote it off, like they've written many things off of the boy.
Yeah, but brothers and sisters, make no mistake about this. These AWOLs will not be written off, and I sincerely hope that these young men have a support system suitable to keep them out of harm's way for a considerable amount of time, because they can't just let it go now.
Yeah, like a ticket to Canada.
There you go. Okay, so what it is, it's two things that Sam don't want. Sam don't want you to see him getting his ass waxed in public. And the other thing that they don't want you to understand that what's happening in Iraq now is not some old fanatic here and there or this or that or Saddam Hussein but is a mass effort to expel the invaders. And the best way these folks know how to expel them is to kill them. And to get them out of their country. So today, also, besides hearing about the five soldiers that died in the, when the helicopter got shot down again, what you also have is Sam is getting desperate. They bombed Iraq again today. Literally. Indiscriminate bombing is their only hope of trying to control the situation, which means they have no hope of controlling the situation.
And this is the Vietnamization process going, where of course they weren't trying to rebuild or anything Vietnam, so they would do indiscriminate bombings, massive bombings. They would do those pile type bombings where anything, you know, within a particular distance would be obliterated, because they would drop so many bombs in unison. So this type of clear-cut bombing is basically a tactic of an enemy who is, of course, not trying to rebuild and all of that other propaganda that they be spewing out, but is basically trying to crush a people's will and spirit into submission.
In vain. It's going to take a whole lot to crush these people. They done put up with Saddam all these damn years.
Well, they've been
pretty tough.
They've been putting up with Sam all these years. All the sanctions, the depleted uranium, the not having access to medical goods, seeing their kids die off and stuff. This is Sam. Sam intentionally bombed the water supply intentionally a couple of years back, knowing that this was an international crime to not hurt Saddam, but to smash up the people. A part of this attack on the Iraqi population had been an attack on the working class of the Iraqi population to help destabilize the working class of the Iraqi population, which helped strengthen its friends and allies in the region.
Thank you very much, Grace. Now we're going to talk a little about the resistance and the Iraqi independence. The initial stages of a guerrilla war. This comes from Tariq Ali in Great Britain. Some weeks ago, Pentagon inmates were invited to a special in-house showing of an old movie. It was the Battle of Algiers. Gillo Ponsiero, sorry, Corvo's anti-colonial classic, initially banned in France. One assumes the purpose of the screening was purely educative. The French won that battle, but lost the war. At least the Pentagon understands that the resistance in Iraq is following a familiar anti-colonial pattern. In the movie, they would have seen acts carried out by the Algerian Maquis almost half a century ago, which could have been filmed in Fallujah or Baghdad last week. Then, as now, the occupying power described all such activities as terrorist. Then, as now, prisoners were taken and tortured. Houses that harbored them or their relatives were destroyed, and repression was multiplied. In the end, the French had to withdraw. And by the way, I thought it was very interesting that I'm not sure. There was some American paper that actually had an editorial stating that they were going to cease to call the resistors, those staging the resistance in Iraq, terrorists. And they were going to begin to call them guerrillas, a lot closer to what they really are. I thought that was interesting.
Well, also, you had pressure by the administration to stop them even calling them resistant fighters and to call them other names because they didn't like the term resistance. Because, you know, resistance...
Terrorist is totally inappropriate.
Yeah, that's true. But my whole point is that they don't like the term resistance because resistance means that you have a particular philosophy or ideological position on something that's trying to be imposed on you that you're resisting against. And the U.S. is just basically trying to create this illusion that nothing but madmen and terrorists would try to resist what they're trying to naturally implicate or implement on the Iraqi population.
I just thought that, Tracy, I just thought that guerrilla was more accurate, though. To say that somebody's guerrilla, you know.
No, I agree it is more accurate. But, you know, like guerrilla resistant movement, you know, because when you talk about resistance and then you see a large number of people, you often hear terms like guerrilla resistance movement, stuff like that. They don't want to hear the term movements and all of that.
No.
Because... these can easily be attached to things that are outside of the parameter of what they want to centralize around Saddam, because they still want to hold Saddam as being the curator of all of this. And Saddam is not seen in the image of being someone involved in a resistance movement,
right,
guerrilla
right.
movement, or anything like that. He's just supposed to be a madman, a terrorist who's just trying to hold on to power and buy people off, you know, and give them millions of dollars to shoot some little G.I. Joe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, as American, quote, post-war, unquote, casualties now exceed those sustained during the invasion, which cost the Iraqis at least 15,000 predominantly innocent lives. A debate of sorts has begun in the U.S. Few can deny that Iraq under U.S. occupation is in a much worse state than it was under Saddam Hussein. There is no reconstruction. There is mass unemployment. Daily life is a misery. And the occupiers and their puppets cannot provide even the basic amenities of life. The U.S. doesn't even trust the Iraqis to clean their barracks. And so South Asian and Filipino migrants are being used. This is colonialism in the epoch of neoliberal capitalism. And so U.S. and so-called friendly companies are given precedence. Even under the best circumstances, an occupied Iraq would become an oligarchy of crony capitalism, the new cosmopolitanism of Bechtel and Halliburton. It is the combination of all this that fuels the resistance and encourages many young men to fight. Few are prepared to betray those who are fighting. This is crucially important because without the tacit support of the population, a sustained resistance is virtually impossible. The Iraqi Maquis have weakened George Bush's position in the U.S. and enabled Democrat
politicians to criticize the White House, with Howard Dean daring to suggest a total U.S. withdrawal within 2 years. Even the Bien peasant, Pensance, who oppose the war but support the occupation and denounce the resistance, know that without it, they would have been confronted with a triumphant chorus from the warmongers. Most important, the disaster in Iraq has indefinitely delayed further adventures in Iraq, Iran, and Syria. One of the more comical sights in recent months was Paul Wolfowitz on one of his many visits informing a press conference in Baghdad that the, quote, main problem was that there were too many foreigners in Iraq. Most Iraqis see the occupation armies as the real, quote, foreign terrorists, unquote. Why? Because once you occupy a country, you have to behave in a colonial fashion. This happens even where there is no resistance, as in the protectorates of Bosnia and Kosovo. Where there is resistance, as in Iraq, the only model on offer is a mixture of Gaza and Guantanamo. Nor does it behoove Western commentators whose countries are occupying Iraq to lay down conditions for those opposing it. It is an ugly occupation, and this determines the response. According to Iraqi opposition sources, there are more than 40 different resistance organizations in the field right now. They consist of Baathists. Baathists would be like, you know, the Baathist party would be Saddam's party, okay? Dissident communists, that is, the official communist party went into the government, went into this so-called government council. But there are the Workers' Communist Party of Iraq. They're opposed to the occupation. And there are apparently are members of the Communist Party who are ready to break with the official Communist Party of Iraq because they oppose the resistance. Disguised by the treachery of the Iraqi Communist Party and backing the occupation, disgusted, that's the dissident communists, nationalist groups of Iraqi soldiers and officers disbanded by the occupation, and Sunni and Shia religious groups. Well, that's damn near everybody. Shit. Only one he didn't mention was the Kurds. And you know what? Well, we'll see about that. The great poets of Iraq, Saidi, Yusef, and Mudhafa el-Nawab, once brutally persecuted by Saddam, but still in exile, are the conscience of their nation. Their angry poems denouncing the occupation and heaping scorn on the jackals, or quislings, that is the Uncle Toms is helping, that's working with Sam, help to sustain the spirit of resistance and renewal. Here's a couple of examples. Yosef writes, "I'll spit in the jackals' faces. I'll spit on their lists. I'll declare that we are the people of Iraq. We are the ancestral trees of this land." And Nawab, well, here's a little selection of his work. "And never trust a freedom fighter who turns up with no arms. Believe me, I got burnt in that crematorium. Truth is, you're only as big as your cannons, while those who wave knives and forks simply have eyes for their stomachs." In other words, the resistance is predominantly Iraqi, though I would not be surprised if other Arabs are crossing the borders to help. If there are Poles and Ukrainians in Baghdad and Naif, why should Arabs not help each other? The key fact of the resistance is that it is decentralized, the classic first stage of guerrilla warfare against an occupying army. Yesterday's downing of a U.S. Chinook, the downing of that Chinook, we talked about that earlier, folks, follows that same pattern. Whether these groups will move to the second stage and establish an Iraqi National Liberation Front remains to be seen. As for the UN acting as a, quote, honest broker, unquote, forget it. Especially in Iraq, where it is part of the problem, leaving aside its previous record as the administrator of the killer sanctions and the backer of weekly Anglo-American bombing raids for 12 years. That's right, that's what the UN did. It was under the fig leaf of the UN that they carried that shit out. On October the 16th, the Security Council disgraced itself again by welcoming, quote, the progressive response of the international community to the broadly representative governing council and supports the governing council's effort to mobilize the people of Iraq. What kind of madness is this? Nobody in the world recognized that so-called governing council. Not even in Jordan, right next to Iraq, on the border. Or Syria, right next to Iraq, on its border. Do they recognize this bullshit governing council, handpicked by the imperialists? Meanwhile, a beaming fraudster, Ahmed Chalabi, oh yeah, he ain't worth a shit, was given the Iraq seat at the UN. Ain't that a damn... So that show you what the UN is about. That they couldn't even get it to say, look, yo, blood, you don't represent nobody. Get your ass up out of here. You can't sit in that seat. No, but they let him take the seat. Who are they... accommodating U.S. imperialism. One can't help recalling how the U.S. and Britain insisted on Potball retaining his seat for over a decade after being toppled by the Vietnamese. You remember who Potball was? We talking about the killing fields, y'all. When the Vietnamese said, that's it, the Cambodian people have suffered long enough, and they moved in there and cleaned it up and ran his old crazy ass out of the country. The United States supported Pot Paul holding that seat in the UN over a decade. The U.S. and Britain. Can you imagine? Think about that. Go back and check the record on those killing fields I was talking about. It was very serious. The only norm recognized by the Security Council is brute force, and today there is only one power with the capacity to deploy it. That is why, for many in the Southern Hemisphere, and elsewhere, the UN is the U.S. Makes sense to me. The Arab East is today the venue of a dual occupation. The U.S.-Israeli occupation of Palestine and Iraq. If initially the Palestinians were demoralized by the fall of Baghdad, the emergence of a resistance movement has encouraged them. After Baghdad fell, the Israeli war leader, Ariel Sharon, told the Palestinians to, quote, come to your senses now that you are, your protector has gone, unquote. As if the Palestinian struggle was dependent on Saddam or any other individual, this old colonial notion that the Arabs are lost without a headman is being contested in Gaza and in Baghdad. And were Saddam to drop dead tomorrow, the resistance would increase rather than die down. Sooner or later, all foreign troops will have to leave Iraq. If they do not do so voluntarily, they will be driven out. Their continuing presence is a spur to violence. When Iraq's people regain control of their own destiny, they will decide the internal structures and external policies of their country. One can hope that this will combine democracy and social justice, a formula that is set Latin America alike, but is greatly resented by the empire. He's talking about the U.S. empire. Meanwhile, Iraqis have one thing of which they can be proud and of which British and U.S. citizens should be envious. An opposition. Oh, yes. Tariq Ali, by the way, has a new book that's out, and y'all might be interested in checking it out. It's called Bush in Babylon: Recolonization of Iraq, and is published by Verso Press.
Another point that should be made is that the U.S. has found that so many Iraqis are so well armed that it's basically impossible to disarm the whole population, and this has caused a lot of drama and death for the U.S. See, this is why the empires push gun control. This should be a clear indication to all these little weak liberals and stuff like that. They're not pushing gun control because some little confused Negro is shooting his brother down the street or anything like that. they want to enforce gun control to weaken the masses of people for just these types of occasions. An article came out about a bunch of G.I. Joes and U.S. officials crying about how well-armed the Iraqi people are and how just about every male has an AK in the home. Well, now you see why if you're an Iraqi. Now you should see why if you live in America.
Well, brothers and sisters, and especially y'all brothers, is a draft in the forecast? The Pentagon has put out the help wanted sign. Help wanted, suckers in short supply. With winter approaching, it appears the White House may start feeling a bit drafty. It's not a matter of poor insulation, but rather the result of mounting evidence that the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld war in Iraq is not going well, and there may well be need to be more U.S. troops sent to Iraq. The shoot-down of the Chinook helicopter, causing the death of 15 soldiers and the wounding of another 21, is a good example of the problem. And by the way, go around some of your draft centers. Get yourself some ice cream or soda, a little chair. Just sit down there and watch. Let's see how many the masses is flocking to these military recruitment centers these days. All of the people that have been called in now, they talking about calling in, check this out, Tracy, 50,000 of the reservists. 50,000 more. There ain't many of them left either. And these dudes was basically scamming the government, you know, taking that little bit of money, do their little exercise once a month. Then once a year, they go away for 2 weeks, like a little vacation, and they play soldiers, see? So they said, okay, come on now. You got to do the real thing. What? Say what? It's a damn shame.
And they just called back a bunch of Marines, too, who were the first line shock troops to enter. So they did their shock troop stuff, so they were supposed to be done. And they were at home, you know, telling war stories and stuff. And all of a sudden, that phone rang. Wow!
Oh, boy. It turns out this military disaster was, in large part, the direct result of a shortage of troops on the ground. With the military's 134,000 troops in Iraq spread so thin, there was nobody available to secure the area around the helicopter landing zone in what is acknowledged to be a high-risk area, because helicopters are particularly vulnerable to attack during their slow landings and ascents. It is a standard procedure to secure the perimeter of landing areas. But in this instance, the military had to abandon standard practice and take a little chance. There were no soldiers available to protect the area. A New York Times column following the shoulder-fired missile attack notes correctly that because of the high number of personnel required for support, maintenance, and high-tech back-office functions in Rumsfeld's lean and mean military, actually only some 56,000 of the 134,000 U.S. troops in Iraq are available to carry out to carry guns. Now check this out. See that? Now you got to know this though. This is true of any type of war activity that's bona fide. Traditionally, you've always had for one man in the field, you're going to have 10 in support of at some capacity. See? But the truth is, they don't give a shit about these soldiers. That's what you can see from all of this.
You know, just like the report that has come out about, they didn't even have enough vests for the little G.I. Joes. Not enough vests. So they said, what's going out there? You'll be all right.
No, that's not funny. I do not have...
This is a reflection of how much contempt they have for the working class population.
That's right.
If you're dumb enough to believe all that garbage that they spill and then root your little G.I. Joes on, then they feel that, look, man, we can just tell these fools anything.
Oh, yeah.
And their attention span is so short, even if they do hear a little hit about how already the first U.S. soldier in the Iraq War II has already been homeless. And then it just kind of just goes out the memory banks. So someone already, a G.I. Joe soldier from the Iraq War, this one, has already been made homeless. And what happened was she got real sick. She was bitten up by a lot of mosquitoes, 120-degree heat. Remember, they only let you have 2 bottles of water a day. You're out there in all that heat and stuff, breathing in all this dust that's infected with, you know, all kinds of chemicals and
radiation.
Right, radiation. She fell into a little coma and stuff. Legs got all swole up. She was out of commission for 3 months. She had a kid. They gave her a medical discharge while she was discombobulated.
Oh, no.
And then she wasn't able to pay her rent or anything. So they just threw her ass out in the street.
Oh, man. Make you want to holler. Make you want to holler. So since these guys, that the guys out there in the field, need to eat and sleep, at best, there are only 28,000 U.S. troops available to patrol all of Iraq, a hostile country the size of California, at any given time.
It's basically impossible because people can shoot at you at any moment, so on and so forth. I mean, look, they saw how tough and rough it can get in a kind of rural slash urban setting in Somalia. As the population becomes enraged and once again is armed well because they don't have gun control and is willing to put their lives on the line, that even a well-armed and well-trained killing machine like the U.S. can find itself in an extreme hot spot. You know, that whole Somalia thing happened over a one-day course. It lost like 18 guys and countless numbers were killed. So it's just right now that the Iraqi population is getting to the point where it's tapping about, you know, the highest number is like, 16 or 18 dead in one day. So that was a good day's work. You know, generally it had been 2 or 3 at the most. Now they're just getting to that point. But if you look at the Somalia thing, how fierce it was and how much the resolve of the little Negroes was that, you know, in one night.
Right. Gotta go see that film, by the way, y'all. Rent it. You know why? Because even a lion sack of shit that the film is, you get a sense of the arrogance and the stupidity of the American high command.
Actually, I would also recommend reading the book, Black Hawk Down, because you get more of a feel and it's not as sensationalized in a kind of American patriotic. You know, you see, you know, some of the pictures like the little G.I. Joe that's dragged. You got his ass dragged out. You remember him? Well, they left that out in the movie and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, if they bow down to political pressure like they're bowing down to this Reagan movie, mm-hmm. You know, for political pressure and stuff like that.
So cancel it.
Right. So the book is much more detailed and much more nuanced and gives you much more insight to the drama that occurred. A couple of documentaries on the subject also give you more insight on that issue.
Okay, well, I tell you what. There were hopes at the White House and in the Pentagon that Turkey would ride to the rescue with an influx of armed troops. But like India and Pakistan before it, Turkey has thought better of this incredibly bad idea and now says it will not participate in the U.S. war and occupation. That announcement assures that the U.S. will, at a minimum, have to call up more reservists and National Guard soldiers for Iraq duty during this election year. It cannot wait. But besides the political problems of calling up more weekend soldiers for active duty, the reality is that there simply are not enough Americans in uniform to handle a bigger war in Iraq. It should come as no surprise, then, even as the president and his advisors continue to claim that everything is going well and according to plan, that saner heads at the Pentagon are taking steps to prepare for the return of the draft. That's what's happening. You know what? Looking at a Defense Department news website called Defend America that provides Pentagon reports about the so-called, quote, war on terrorism to, quote, military communities. The government put out a call for volunteers to help fill the hundreds of vacancies in over 2,000 local draft boards and draft appeal boards. Now get this. Currently, draft board members also report that last summer they were urged to go out and recommend people to fill these vacancies, which currently ran at about 16% nationwide. The goal, according to the Selective Service spokesman, is to have the draft machinery ready to go at the click of a finger. Of course, the time between the click and the delivery of the first cannon fodder to Army boot camps for training would not be such a smooth or quick process. First, Congress would have to pass a bill authorizing a draft. Then, it would have to be signed by the president. At that point, the Selective Service Law says the Selective Service System has 193 days to deliver the first draftee to the tender mercies of the military. A draft would be a political disaster for this president. So most military experts say it is unlikely that a return to the conscription would occur before November 2004. You see, this is all a game. These people have no principle. They're going to just try to let it go like that, like it's going to keep people out there what they got. And then right on November 5th, your ass is going to the Army. Believe that. Oh, man, isn't that cold? So just so they can get back in there for another 4 years, and then your ass is gone. But if the guerrilla war in Iraq continues to get worse, the day after that election, the president could well be forced to decide on either a phased withdrawal or escalation and a national call-up. Faced with the same choices in Southeast Asia, President Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon both chose escalation over withdrawal. But Bush, what Bush or a Democratic successor would do, other than Dennis Kucinich, they say, and Al Sharpton, huh? Well, don't believe that, because even if they got elected, somehow if all of them was in a plane, all of the Democratic Party candidates was in a plane, and the plane started to fall apart, and old Al said, man, I don't know, I had my little parachute ready because I don't trust white folks. And jumped out the damn plane and lived. So he was the only one left to be president. And that motherfucker got elected. I'm trying to tell you, either they shoot his ass or he would reinstitute the draft. Because that's what's happening right now. They are losing on a certain sense. Because all of the lies and the illusions that they tried to pass around have come crashing down to the ground, y'all. I'm trying to tell you. Ain't no Democrat can help you. Representative Charles Rangel, Democrat from New York, and retiring Senator Fritz Hollings, Democrat from South Carolina, have companion draft authorization bills in the House and Senate. Rangel, for his part, argues that a universal draft based on a lottery would be fairer than the present system, which he calls an economic draft, which forces low-income people without job prospects into military service. So far, their bills have languished for lack of Republican support. But as the rosy assumptions of the war advocates in the Bush administration continue to be disproven, Republican hawks in Congress and the White House could well begin pushing for more troops to, quote, do the job right, unquote. According to Charles Pena, director of defense studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute, the closest model to the current Iraq occupation is Northern Ireland. There, he says, British so-called pacification efforts required a force ratio of 10 soldiers to every 1,000 citizens. And at the height of the Northern Ireland conflict, a ratio of 20 soldiers to every 1,000 people. Now, quote, If you transfer that to Iraq, it would mean that you need at least 240,000 troops and maybe as many as 480,000 troops, says Pena. The U.S. military, with a total of 1.4 million in uniform, would have to strip every fighting unit domestically and around the globe to come up with such numbers. As impossible move that would leave the U.S. and many of its overseas strategic interests completely unguarded. Because remember, Sam is everywhere. They're in Africa. They're in Japan. They're in Korea. They're in Germany. They're in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. All over Latin America. So what they going to do? Oh, and you the cop of the world. Yeah, buddy. That's a serious
responsibility.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. Tracy one got me laughing here. Because it's not funny on a certain level, y'all. But it's the contradictions that do bring up the irony of this situation. Because we know this ain't no laughing matter. Recall that during Vietnam, when the U.S. had a military about twice as large as today, fielding a force of 500,000 soldiers required a major conscription program. Clearly, if the war keeps getting worse, there is a draft in the forecast. And check this out, just so y'all know. Look out for pickets. We picketing. They done brought the pickets from down Southern California, and they picketed Safeway up here. Bravo. That's a good thing. Spread it, because they try to screw everybody, not just the people in Southern California. So if you see that picket, we boycott Safeway. It's on. The union doesn't say, don't buy nothing from Safeway. Well, you look, here in the Bay Area, you ain't got no damn excuse. There's neighborhood stores. There's farmers markets. You can eat. You're going to find a way to eat and eat aplenty without crossing those informational picket lines. They're not on strike, but they're appealing to your consciousness. Talk to your cousins, your mother, the people you go to school with, your workmates, your colleagues, whoever you run with, at work, school, play. Spread the word. To hell with Safeway. Protect your right to have a medical plan when you do get a job. Because that's what this is all about. Solidarity with the struggling workers. Just wanted to bring to your attention. Also, in Lebanon, there was a successful 24-hour general strike against the government's cuts. Yes, people do something when they're attacked. If one were to search for the simplest example of a lack of coverage of an important labor movement event by the international media of the capitalists, Lebanon is the most recent case. A 24-hour general strike took place in Lebanon last week, but it was hardly reported outside of Lebanon. The Daily Star reported preparations for Thursday's all-out strike were underway on Wednesday as General Labor Confederation, GLC, urged the Labor Ministry to be alert for complaints about employers who refuse to give their staff a paid day off during the walkout. You understand? They got the sense enough to tell the employer, not only are we going on strike, punk, but you gonna pay us, bitch. Oh, I'm sorry. That's the way it is. Ain't no more nice guy shit. When they went on strike in Iraq, they went and told the man, look, we got to get some more money. My man drew down on them. The supervisor drew down on the workers. The workers went home, got the AKs, and came back to work and said, look at here, we striking. They won the strike. I'm not advocating that every time we you know, go to negotiate with employers, we put a gun in between their foreheads. But this is the real world here. This is the class line. So these people got paid for striking.
Well, it's very interesting. German journalist that I've been talking to, one just an hour ago, who have worked on law enforcement matters and are very senior, assure me that both the American FBI and the German counterintelligence service had these people under surveillance as early as 1998, and the German police sources, complain would be too strong a word, but express annoyance that the FBI, they say, did not share all the information they had with the Germans. The FBI is very active in Germany. They've got a full station in Berlin and have had for some time, as the German federal police do in Washington. As Mohammed Atta, who piloted the first plane that hit the World Trade Center, was a student at this technical university in Hamburg, as were two of his companions, as was Sabiki and Shelhi. One of the two Shelhi brothers, at least, studied there. He was piloting the second plane, we think. There was a third man, very important, named Bahaji, who has disappeared. His mother and his wife say that he's gone to Pakistan for an internship and he'll be back, but he's listed as missing and wanted by the German police, and there are warrants out for a number of others of the Hamburg group. The German police remark that immediately after the attacks in New York, they asked the FBI for anything that would help them in the investigation in Germany, and instantly the FBI produced a full database on these people, particularly against Mohammed Atta. And the Germans were struck by the fact that they must have been under surveillance by the Americans for some time to have built up such a big database. It appears that they were monitoring them even in Germany before they left for the U.S. I don't know of military training for these particular people. Of course, the military training for bin Laden type terrorists goes way back to the Afghan War of 79 to 89, when the CIA and Pakistani military intelligence took charge of training this army of Muslim mercenaries who were to fight and eventually expel the Russians from Afghanistan in the 80s. But more recent military training in the States, I have not heard of. Effort to identify and run down bin Laden and affiliates' worldwide assets, I would refer to Greek mythology, where, as you know, Hercules was assigned, I think, 12 labors. And this would certainly be the 13th and most difficult of all. It's going to be an immense task. I have just read a 70-page intelligence report. It's over a year old, but extremely detailed, with names and addresses around the world of bin Laden's assets and the companies he has invested in or helped, or and the people and firms he has been associated with in various ways. The list reaches all the way from Saudi Arabia, of course, the bin Laden Construction Group, which is still the biggest construction group, I believe, in the world, all the way to the Far East, to Kuala Lumpur, to the Philippines, to many main European as well as Arab banks. And untangling all this and determining responsibilities and who are the real owners of bank accounts is really a Herculean task. And I would almost think that it might be called Mission Impossible.
attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Recently, Bill O'Reilly has found himself in a little heat as he's been basically crying the blues about the unfairness of people smacking him around. You know, like one guy wrote the book, The O'Reilly Factor. Then Terry Gross ran him off the show and he went crying. And then another dude, Al Franken, wrote a book about the lion media of Fox News and stuff like that. So he's running around the planet pretending like everyone's out to get him, from the New York Times to Terry Gross. But let's see and hear O'Reilly in his own words and on how he handles many of these issues. Now, this is going back a little ways, intentionally. Let's see how O'Reilly dealt with some of the issues of war in Iraq before the imperialist war started. So first off, Patrick from Nebraska chimes in on O'Reilly's radio show. Let's see what they have to say together, and we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Let's go to Patrick in Omaha, Nebraska. What say you, Patrick?
Well, I see it like this. History has a tendency to repeat itself, and looking at Saddam Hussein, he just looks like another Hitler to me. And if we give him another shot, as you keep saying, I agree absolutely, he's just going to do something terrible. The Allies, our allies right now, aren't doing anything, and that's because they haven't had a plane crash into the Kremlin or Buckingham Palace or anything like that, you know?
Well, you're right. I mean, look, everybody in the world, unfortunately, is motivated by self-interest. And the self-interest of the people in Europe are not what the self-interest of the people in the United States are. And here's the big thing. The Europeans, and I'm talking about the governments now, not the folks, they don't care if Israel is wiped off the face of the earth. They don't care. Okay, so if Saddam Hussein launches some nuclear device into Tel Aviv or Jerusalem and just kills hundreds of thousands of people, they don't care. We do. That's the difference.
First off,
give me a break.
See, this is how O'Reilly and them, this is why he's a slime ball and he's no good. Check out how he says that if Saddam launches a nuclear device into Israel and wiped it out, the Europeans wouldn't care. Now, once again, he's insinuating that that's what I'm about to say, that he has nuclear weapons, that he is the threat. You know, he poses the threat. This all legitimized in the minds of the, you know, minuscule Boy George's war rhetoric. He ties into all of that stuff. Now, it was unfounded then. For more people, it's clear that it's unfounded now. But see, this is how O'Reilly plays the game. Now, many of these Europeans, they don't want to see Israel wiped off the map. Many Europeans don't want to see these escalations of war, but they want Israel to be accountable. One, they don't want Israel bombing up the Palestinians. You often hear a lot of Europeans wanting Israel to abide by the resolutions that they're always ignoring. They want Israel to get rid of its nuclear weapons. It's Israel the one that's loaded down with atomic weapons. So, but in the game and world of the Bill O'Reilly show, you can get up there and compare Saddam to Hitler. Now, Saddam's a creation of capitalist imperialism. So if so, that comparability to Hitler, because Hitler was a creation of capitalist imperialism. If that's what you're comparing him on, then okay, he's a much lightweight one. But, you know, just on that very narrow strand. But other than that, shut the hell up. But see, when you hear O'Reilly yapping and talking about everyone in the world is motivated by self-interest, but he's not going to talk about the class interests, the U.S. corporate class interests. None of this is geared for any kind of class or developmental knowledge. It's this rhetoric prone and propaganda that's thrown out there. Now next, Bob from Florida chimes in on why Saddam has to be taken out on the O'Reilly show. Let's see how they both deal with this and we'll take it from there. Check.
We do. Bob in Sarasota, Florida. What say you, Bob?
Oh, I believe we have to take him out right away. That's number one. This may cause a World War III, but the real countries that are going to be on our side are the ones that know the good from the bad.
Well, it's probably going to be Britain. That's probably going to be it. It's going to be the United States and England against everybody else. But I don't agree with the World War III, Bob. Look, what it comes down to is this. The United States is so powerful that we can wipe out anyone, anywhere, at any time. All right? They know that. The North Koreas of the world know that. So they basically will stay in their own little pen because they know that we can kill them. And that's what Saddam Hussein is basically doing right now. The problem is that once Saddam Hussein gets bacteria, Ebola or smallpox or any of that, once he gets a delivery system for that, then he can hand it off to Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda can bring it into Des Moines, can bring it into Seattle. And we can't let that happen. See, that's the threat here. We know that Hussein has done it to the Kurds. He launched scuds against the Israeli civilians. We know that he will do it. Why give him the chance? When we can take him out, nobody's going to come up to his... They're going to give a lot of rhetoric, but nobody's going to come to his defense. There's nobody going to stand in the way of our tanks in Baghdad. Nobody. You saw what happened to the Al-Qaeda guys who came over to Afghanistan. They're all sitting in Guantanamo Bay. All right, that's a lesson to be learned there.
See, now, once again, this was before the war actually started. My whole point in playing this is I take this fool knowing that I'm going to at one time make these fools eat their words because they're such propagandists. They're so much caught in the art of illusion and they help facilitate non-critical thinking. All of this rhetoric that he is saying, this stuff about once Saddam gets the delivery weapon and gives it to Al-Qaeda, there was no connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. But then that connection, once that happens and he gets the delivery weapon, then gives it to Al-Qaeda, once then the next night, Al-Qaeda and the weapons are in your bedroom choking you to death. That's the implication. And then he goes on to how no one can stand up to the U.S. and all of that. Now, this is out of any kind of historical type of analysis or connection.
That's right.
What happened in Vietnam? Now, of course, the U.S. had overwhelming power, but that's not how these types of things play themselves out when you have various alliances, when you have people motivated, when you have certain terrains that are favorable, when you're trying to be an occupying force, so you're not just grinding people and machine gunning them down all the time, but you got to stand out there and play policeman. You get picked off, stuff like that. The morale goes down. But see, none of this is taken into account by O'Reilly because he's not trying to encourage amongst his listeners any kind of critical thinking. It's all rah-rah, patriotic, red, white, and blue, pro-imperialist propaganda.
You know what? It's also against common logic. Anybody to say the United States ain't never lost, no. You can't do just running it and running it. It just ran your monkey ass out of goddamn Somalia. That little ass David whooped a whole lot of Sam ass. open up a big old gallon of whoop ass. And the next thing you know, y'all was gone. And you notice I say y'all, because it ain't my army. I got sense enough to know that. But then, wait, Tracy just pointed out Vietnam. And here's the other thing. So he said, oh, well, Korea ain't going to do... Well, Korea answered the United States. They basically said, fuck with me, and the United States will be a sea of fire. Now, Koreans are not stupid. They know that the likelihood is the United States will bomb the shit out of them, too. But you know what? They saying, fuck it. And this is the kind of attitude you engender with this bullying bullshit. And now, let's look at what Riley said, and let's look at what the United States actually has done. Has the United States continued to talk that bullshit? And I'm sorry, y'all, I don't mean to, you know, just use bad words, but what else can you call it? Because now they're talking about, well, we're going to have a discussion with them about nuclear weapons, and hopefully we will be able to... Yeah, mother. You, man, look. This is good to hear what they were saying 8 months ago, 9 months ago, and then just to use your own sense and look at what's actually happening. Nothing that this idiot said is coming to pass. And he got it all wrong.
And then he's crying because people attack him and critique him. And he tries to claim that he's on some kind of high intellectual level that should be above these types of frivolous attack, quote unquote. Now, next, here's when O'Reilly took on Ludacris, you know, the little hip-hop artist, over the Pepsi commercials, you know, because he had at one time a Pepsi contract. And O'Reilly basically launched a campaign against him. So O'Reilly has on a Pepsi representative for having on Ludacris. So let's see how this transpired and just put things together beyond the shadow. Check this out.
Promote Pepsi, and they're going to run some commercials in the MTV Awards. And most people, of course, don't know what Ludacris is. I'll read a couple of lyrics, a couple of reviews, and then we'll talk to the Pepsi guy who's hanging on the phone. Ludacris's latest album contains a song that says, I'm DUI, hardly ever caught sober, and you are about to get run the F over. Grab the peels, because we robbing tonight, beat the S out of security, we starting a fight. Boston Globe says Ludacris's lyrics seem harsh and sexually demeaning on many of the tracks. Okay, all of them. The Entertainment Weekly Review says, if you're inured to hip-hop's relentless If you're inured to hip-hop's relentless conflation, good word, of sex and thuggery, you'll likely view lines like Ludacris's as good dirty fun. Murder case in San Antonio. Guy says he pulled the trigger after Ludacris came on the radio because he was so pumped up by the song. Okay. Let's bring in Bart Casabona, who's the spokesman for Pepsi-Cola up in Purchase, New York. Mr. Casabona, surely you know that Ludacris is going to be controversial. What say you?
Well, you know, with that said, I mean, Ludacris is one of today's most popular performers, and he's broadly appealing among teens of all ethnicities.
Yeah.
And that's really what we target with these, advertisements.
So you don't really care about his morals or the message that he puts out?
Well, for us, it's really about how he's portrayed in our advertising. As you see in our commercials, if you had a chance to view them, we capitalize on his ability to connect with our target audience in a relevant manner.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, but again, the question is, you don't care about his morals or his message. You basically care that kids will pay attention to him, and he's drinking Pepsi, so they might.
Well, again, you know, when you look at our advertising, you'll notice that we focus on his ability to connect our brand.
Yeah.
Okay, now, part of the reason why I put this out is that here, O'Reilly, someone who backs George Bush, a person who backs this administration, who backs Rumsfeld, who backs an administration that leaks the names of its own CIA agents because the husband has basically called him on a lie concerning the Niger uranium Iraq connection. Now, there's no outrage about this type of lack of decent morality or the message that it means when you have heads of states lying to its public. See, O'Reilly doesn't get riled up about that, but the fact that Pepsi gave a little contract to the little hip-hop artist, Ludacris, this gets him going to the point where he helps launch a campaign against Pepsi, so they ended up dropping Ludacris from the contract.
They did.
Oh, yeah. So this is the types of moral, quote-unquote, campaigns someone like O'Reilly leads, while at the same time, he's a propagandist for world imperialism.
Absolutely.
See, it's a sideshow. Now, let me just say this one thing about hip-hop and all of this, because there's a lot of confusion always going on and stuff. You know, when hip-hop first started and stuff, it was basically bought and by the people who were the originators of it, black and Puerto Ricans. So hip-hop reflected the goals, aspirations, dreams, and contradictions of that population. So at one time when blacks and Puerto Ricans were the predominant buyers, you saw like social political hip-hop, kind of a religious-based hip-hop, you know, Invisible Man, Believers, Christian-based, Islamic, a kind of a black feminist hip-hop, kind of a thuggery street hip-hop. You know, you had all of those elements, conscious hip-hop and stuff like that. And no one style dominated over another, you know, because it was more of an honest reflection of, you know, the black community and stuff, which has those goals, dreams, aspirations, and contradictions. But as the market system shifted, as hip-hop became more nationalized and internationalized, black and Latinos, predominantly Puerto Ricans, were no longer the main buyers of the music. And now it shifted into another region of the population. And what ended up happening through that market force was then you had a situation where you started to see that the interest of those people, basically white people, who wanted to listen to hip-hop, started to be reflective of what they had historically had interest in. So one, you started to see, one, the dominance and emergence of the Sambo image. In other words, historically, pre-Civil War, a character that was created by white racism in all the minstrelly, played by white performers, was the Sambo. He was a happy slave. He wore all of his top clothes on him, you know, all of his material wealth, you know, top hat, so on and so forth. He often talked about, well, look here, I found two chickens the other day. And if I find two more chickens, I'll be a rich man. And, you know, and the white folks would love this because this was the safest Negro in the world, a Negro that did not know that he was still a slave, who thought he was on top of the world. These bling bling Negroes that you see now wearing all the gold are just a modern day adaptation to that whole thing. That's just a modern day adaptation, wearing all of the jewelry and this and that, dancing around like they're on top of the world. Then after the Civil War, blacks could no longer be seen just in the happy-go-Negro image when you had 200,000-plus black folks fight and die to get their freedom by any means necessary, i.e. we picked up the gun, Frederick Douglass style. So then another method had to be created to control that the black population and to control the image of that population. So then you saw the emergence of the D.W. Griffith Birth of a Nation Zip Coon image. This was the razor-toting, hiding behind the bush, sexual predator ready to rape your mama, your white mama, at every gesture. Now, once again, these thugs, gangsters, shoot your mama in the ass are a modern day adaptation to the Zip Coon image. But this has been created and manifested by the whole market forces. This what you see hip-hop now is a result of a market-based system. All of these people who believe in the market, these little Negro ministers who are out breaking the hip-hop CDs and stuff like that, they'll turn right around and preach the gospel of the market.
Right.
But it's been the market that has bastardized the culture, our culture in the first place. And not just hip-hop. You know, there is no more John Coltranes. There's no Thelonious Monks. There's no Miles Davises. No Minguses. All of these people who existed in the same era and were doing their thing. There's no more creation of that because... in this market-based, spit-em-out, go-get-em, you know, decadent culture that is overridden a vital core and thread of the black culture that has historically been a cornerstone of resistance and resilience, well, this is what you get.
You know, I just wanted to... Nothing really can be added to what my comrade just said. In fact, I want to... steal that. I'm gonna get a tape of this show and put that out as a damn pamphlet, because that's what the young people need to be hearing. That is the truth. But just to confirm what Tracy talking about, let me show you something. I was reading something before I came. You know, I'm always reading stuff to bring you information. And I saw this thing about 50 Cent had did a concert. You understand what I'm saying? And it is as if they were trying to prove that Tracy was right. Here's 50 Cent. The black entertainer made his first CD. What was it? His first CD was Get Rich or Die Trying. Think about this. What is that but a distillation of bourgeois ideology? That's exactly what they want you out there saying. That's what you want to do. Get rich or die trying. Don't care who you kill. Your mama, if she get in the way. Then, who's he singing this crap in front of? 2,000 white teenagers. I'm not, you know, look, y'all, this is, I'm just saying, that's what happened. Bullseye, Tracy.
And it's clear that until we put a bullseye in you know whose head, Sam, this madness will keep on going until it can't go on much longer. Hold on a sec. Well, that's going to just about wrap it up with Slade tonight. So from the resistance that you see going on with the brothers and sisters in Iraq to the resistance you see sisters and brothers doing at the Safeway stores and on the longshoremen who are resisting the brutality of the attacks of the police to us consciously resisting what they're trying to do to our soul, our culture, our music, our own well-being, we have to realize that we're going to have to keep playing and staying on the other side of the game until the next time, Slave Revolt.